come into the expansion of the church in the West, and we're really going to take the broad view of this, but I want you to pick up on this because I think it is very, very important to understand, if we're going to have any grasp at all, the history of the church in the early Middle Ages. First of all, we look at the British Isles. By the British Isles, we mean the Ireland, England, Scotland. We have there are late traditions. There's 6th and 7th century, which date the evangelization of Celtic England. The aboriginal people, or at least the earlier people of England, were called the Celts. According to tradition, I think it ought to be interesting to you, unless your brain's on the back burner permanently. There's an early tradition, a late tradition, just a story, probably not true, that Joseph of Arimathea was supposed to have not only gone to England when it was Celtic, before the Anglo-Saxons moved in, and took with him the chalice used by Jesus, the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, called the Holy Grail. And I'm just noting the syllabus for future study, a reference, that this is the context of the Arthurian legend. What is the Arthurian legend? King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, you hear about the search for the Holy Grail, trying to find the Holy Grail, which was brought to England by Joseph of Arimathea. Well, that goes back to about the 6th and 7th century, those traditions. Christianity is found there as early as the 3rd century, perhaps brought there by traders from Gaul. But in 410, we've already noted, the Roman Empire withdrew its troops, and in 449, the Anglo-Saxons, a Germanic people, here's Saxony. Saxony is northern Germany, but later the Holy Roman Empire here is later called Germany. We're going to look at this again next quarter because Luther was from Saxon. He was a Saxon. The Anglo-Saxon people moved over and pushed the Celts to this. They just pushed them over until the remnant you had, you still have vestiges of Celtic culture in what is called Wales. And Wales is simply the west coast of England. Richard Burton is Welsh. And there still has survived there the ancient Celtic tongue, which is very much a foreign language to us. And some of the Celts were driven up into Scotland. And so the Anglo-Saxons at this time, of course, were not converted, were not Christians in any sense of the term. So that's the first thing we say, that the early tradition, two things, the early tradition, that while England was still Celtic, that Joseph of Arimathea came to evangelize and brought the Holy Grail, just a legend, very old legend though, and there may be some truth in it, you never know. But then later on, after the Roman Empire crumbled in the West, I give you the date of 449, the Anglo-Saxons moved across the channel and squeezed in the Celts, conquered them, and now you have Anglo-Saxon England, and they are not converted. They are still pagan, barbaric tribes. We look at Ireland in the 5th century, that is the 400s, and here we meet famous St. Patrick. And this is, of course, you have history mixed with legend. Patrick is supposed to be the one who drove all the snakes out of Ireland. Patrick was the great apostle to Ireland. He was a Celt from Wales, but he had been taken as a slave to Ireland. The Irish were very, they were very barbaric peoples. He'd been taken as a slave there. He escaped and was converted. This is a long story, but he eventually became a bishop in the church, but he never forgot those wild and woolly people among whom he had lived as a slave, and he vowed to God that he would go convert them, and he did. And monasteries became the center of religious life in Ireland rather than the diocesan bishopric. You see, the center of religious life in Italy and in the East and in the older areas where Christianity had first spread was the bishop and his diocese, the diocesan bishop, I was sorry to say, whether he was a local bishop or a metropolitan bishop or a patriarchal bishop. But the center of Christianity, that arrangement was not there in the early days. As Christianity spread to Ireland, the center of it was the monastery. And by the way, the Irish monasteries were almost the sole havens of culture and learning. I've already said this. And it was the monasteries who sent out missionaries. And they became a very important... And by the way, it was in, just for the sake of your information, I put this note in the syllabus, that the confessional was born in Irish monasteries, very late. The idea was that originally it would help the monks' spiritual life if they confessed to each other. And it was such a good thing, and so it promoted the spirituality and also kept the abbot in control. The fellow's going to be pretty careful what he does if he has to tell you everything. And by the way, it is through the confessional that the Roman Catholic Church now controls its people. Through the confessional. But it was extended to the common people, and it was because it was such a good idea for the monasteries, why not just use it for everybody? But it began, the confessional was started in Irish monasteries in this period. So we have Ireland evangelized by Patrick and others. We move now to Scotland, which is off this map. Scotland, the north of England, you see the little part here. You can visualize the rest of it. Scotland was very wild and woolly. The farther north you went, we talk about the Scandinavian peoples, the Vikings. The farther north you went, the more barbaric they were. The Scottish people were traditionally wild. In fact, the ancients had a common joke among the people that they all, to put it mildly, they always thought that two things were equal in the world, a Scotsman and horse manure. That's exactly what they said. That just sort of, everybody knew that. That was accepted. That was the comparative value of a Scotsman. That's not exactly how they put it, but that was the substance of it. Christianity first came into Scotland from Northern Ireland when an early man called Ninian, who was a Celt, the close of the 4th century, moved up from Northern England, this area where the Celt and. But it didn't take. It was an abortive attempt, as I point out here. The substantive work of Christianizing Scotland took place as the result of the famous Columba, very famous character, Columba in the 6th century. He was to Scotland, Columba was to Scotland what Patrick was to Ireland. And he was an Irishman, so Christianity, as the form that took, went from Ireland to Scotland. Ireland to Scotland. See the steps? Now, his monastery was at Iona on an island. And by the way, there's a new Ionian movement. There's quite a program going on now. Where every summer, monastery at Iona has been reactivated, and every summer there's a group goes there, and a special discipleship movement that's centered now in ancient Iona. But it's a very famous monastery, and here missionaries went out from this monastery to complete the task of converting Scotland. It's interesting that the man who controlled Scotland was the abbot of the monastery of Iona, which was not Columba, by the way. He was a presbyter. He never was an abbot. He never was in charge of the monastery. He was the great evangelizer, but the man who actually controlled it was not a bishop. Remember, I said it was the monastery which was the center, not the diocese. So the man who actually administered Christianity in Scotland was whoever happened to be the abbot of the monastery of Iona. As the monastery, just as the case was with Patrick and Ireland. Are y'all with me? This is quite complicated, and yet I put in this parenthetical study because I think to get a clear picture, you need to understand the kind of Christianity we're talking about. And I list here the important differences between the form and character of Christianity that was brought from Ireland and Scotland as opposed to that which you found further to the south and even to the east, especially to the south. That is, what was Christianity in Scotland the same as it was in what is now France? Answer, no. Some important differences. First of all, independence of the Pope. Iona was the was the Rome of Scotland. Afterwards, Dunkeld, another monastery, and Dunkeld, another abbot, not another monastery. Dunkeld was another abbot who was in charge, or another. Well, he was another presbyter who was in charge. But anyway, the point is independence of the Pope. That is, they didn't openly reject the Bishop of Rome. He just didn't figure in. But you see, the idea, the concept of the papacy as we have it now, this firmly fixed central authority, was not firmly fixed until, on paper, until the 18th century. You see, it's still flexible back then. Monasticism ruled supreme, but it was mixed with secular life and not bound by the vows of celibacy. The monastery was the central institution, but it was a looser arrangement. In the Roman Church, the monastic system, as I point out, was subordinated to the hierarchy of the secular clergy. Third, bishops did not have dioceses and jurisdiction. They did not enjoy succession. You did not have bishops in succession. They were more administrative bishops, but they did function in a sacerdotal way, but you just did not have this diocesan arrangement. They differed in the celebration of the time of Easter, and I won't go into that. They differed in the form of the tonsure, which seems silly to us. In Rome, it was circular. In Scotland, semicircular. What's the tonsure? When the monk became a monk, took his vows, or whatever vows he took, he cut his hair in a certain way. That's called a tonsure. It was a monk's haircut. Now, that may sound like a small difference. It was important to them. It's important back then. Different kind of haircut, which indicated their devotion and their vows. It was the outward sign of their vows, this particular haircut. And last, they were ignorant in Scotland in the second and third centuries, of course, of such ideas as auricular confession, the worship of saints, the images, purgatory, transubstantiation, the seven sacraments. These concepts had not yet evolved. They were just beginning. We've looked at them, just beginning. So they were not fixed anywhere at this time. But due to its geographical isolation and cultural differences, the 6th century Christianity in the British Isles lagged behind continental Christianity as it was across the water in the development of these doctrines. That is, Columba, the form of Christianity he covered was anachronistic. It was older and a less evolved form of doctrine. As a matter of fact, Scotland did not become officially Roman Catholic until 1073. So it was a different kind of Christianity. The differences were not in spirit, they were in form, as I point out. Does that make sense? It's hard for it to think how it would be that way, but you see, it was just a different ball game. And keep in mind, they were way up here. Didn't the bishop, wasn't the Bishop of Rome concerned? But you got to understand, the Bishop of Rome undoubtedly knew very little of what was going on. And if he did know about it, he couldn't do anything about it. See, this was way, you got to understand, in those days, this was like the end of the world. In fact, one of the ancients, even the Lola, one of the names for the lowlands is the Netherlands. What's nether mean? Way and gone. You know, the Netherlands. I mean, you get the end of the world. You know, and it was just the other side of Northern Europe. So in that day, it wasn't as if the Bishop of Rome was really in on it. He couldn't be in on it. And what he did know about, he could not control, because it was a long way off. And keep in mind that medieval society is setting in. People are not traveling. People are pretty well cut off. Very little communication. Very little geographical knowledge. And so it was just another world up there. Does that help you? It wouldn't be anything like it is today, even close. Yes. Well, we hardly don't. In other words, the New Testament church?
We have no record of its existence from this
period. Well, not much. Everything seems to be pretty much this. It's hard to know exactly what people are doing locally, but this is what is historically traceable. And this is the main movement of it.
Well, we move now to Anglo-Saxon England, the 7th century. By now, England is Anglo-Saxon except for the Celtic enclaves, the Celtic pockets, such as Wales. And Christianity came into Anglo-Saxon, into Anglo-Saxon England, as opposed to Celtic England, both from the north and from the south, and it got caught in the middle. It was the from the south, missionaries came out from Rome in the 6th century, 597, early 7th century, sent out by the great Gregory the First. Remember I said he was a great missionary pope? He sent out missionaries into England up from the south. I'm sorry, missionaries from Italy, up from the south. Crossed the English Channel, moved north. Missionaries came down from Iona in Scotland and began to evangelize. But keep in mind that the form of Christianity coming down from the north was older, less evolved, less Roman Catholic, you might say, than the form of Christianity was coming up from the south. You see that? Now, and so a debate arose over, for instance, the date of Easter in the calendar, the Ionian Christianity, Scottish Christianity, keeping the older date, which was kept in the east. Trouble arose, and this was still a tribal society among the Anglo-Saxons. And the famous King Oswy, who was king of one of the 7 major tribes, now keep in mind, he said, well, we're going to be Christians, okay, but we've got to decide which kind we're going to be now. It's kind of like what Constantine, he had the same, even though he was a barbarian, and it was a tribal society, he had basically the problem that Constantine had. Remember the church was divided, and he called the Council of Nicaea? He said, we've got to, if this thing's going to work, we've got to get together. Well, Oswy, in effect, was saying, since Christianity is such an important influence and everybody's being converted, we're going to be Christians. Okay, we'll be Christians. We'll say we're Christians. Again, this is not really what we would call conversion, but it was a matter of a higher culture overcoming a lower culture. We said, okay, we're going to be Christians, but we've got this problem. Which kind of Christian are we going to be? The northern kind or the southern kind? Are we going to be, you know, the kind that doesn't recognize the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, or one that does? The basic issue. And so Oswy let him fight it out, as I point out. Anyway, I cite my source here, the Venerable Bede. He's the early historian of England. He gave the following account. He's the primary source of early English religious history, church history. It's called the Venerable Bede, a very early source. Here is what the Bede wrote, paraphrased, about how this issue was settled. And I think this is interesting, so I put the citation in here for you. He, that is Oswy, let them fight it out, Bede writes. Coleman, a representative of Scottish Christianity from the north, you see, invoked the authority of John, Wilford, representative of Roman Christianity, invoked the authority of Peter. Now, by the way, see, John was the great missionary to Asia, or apostle to Asia, and it was from Asia that had the earlier date for Easter. Remember that remember when Polycarp went to Rome and they argued? Are you with me? So the form of Christianity that came down from Scotland was in many ways similar to that form that was found in the East in these early days. It had not evolved. And so one says, well, I speak by the authority of John. Others, well, Wilford, who came up from Rome, he invoked the authority of Peter. So the debate, now we wouldn't think it was a very scholarly debate, but at least that's how they did it. So the debate was, the question was, are we going to accept the Scottish, Northern Christianity, or, you know, Southern Roman Christianity? And it got down to, are we going to accept the authority of John or Peter? That's how the issues became polarized. When he, that is Wilford, mentioned, the Bede writes, that to Peter were entrusted the keys of the gates of heaven, Oswy responded, did our Lord really say that to Peter? I'll give you the keys of the kingdom. Do you recall how this verse was being used now? By the Bishop of Rome, he claimed the exclusive right to these keys. Being assured by both parties that he did, see, even Coleman had to say, well, I hate to admit this, but as a matter of fact, he said it to Peter. Oswy didn't know. He hadn't read the Bible. He couldn't read anyway. And he hadn't had a Bible to read. You see, he had to take their word for it. And so Coleman had to admit, says, yeah, as a matter of fact, Peter got the keys to the kingdom. Being assured by both parties that he did, even Coleman admitting that he had given no comparable authority to Columba, the king decided in favor of the Roman position. That is, the Bishop of Rome has this authority, not Columba. I must tell you that I am... So anyway, the king decided in favor of the Roman position. He decided they were going to take Southern Christianity. And here's his statement. I must tell you that I am in favor of the Roman position. I must tell you that I am of no mind to contradict the doorkeeper, but desire to obey his ordinances in everything. Otherwise, when I come to the kingdom of heaven, to the gates of the kingdom of heaven, can't read today, there should be none to open them. If I earn the displeasure of the one who so clearly holds the keys, that's his reasoning. He says, well, I got to decide. He didn't care one way or the other. Theologically, he didn't care. But when he found out that it was Peter who had the keys to the gates of heaven, and not Columba, both were dead. Columba was dead now. He said, well, since I'm going to get in, I better not offend the only guy who can let me in. And since Pete is the only guy who can let me in, I'll come down on his side. And so by virtue of that earth-shaking theological decision, Anglo-Saxon England became Roman Catholic. And you know, I think that's humorous, because Oswald didn't want to offend the guy who's watching the gate. From England, the authority of the Bishop of Rome spread to the other British Isles. It was through England Ireland and Scotland later became Roman Catholic. By 703, all of Ireland had accepted the authority of Rome. In 716, Scotland accepted the Roman year, but did not accept full Roman authority until 1073, as I already said. Wales did not accept the authority of the Pope until 1200. Well, so much for that. So do you have the picture here? You have Patrick establishing Christianity in Ireland, or an earlier form of Christianity, and then Columba establishing basically that same form in Scotland. And England, now Anglo-Saxon, is caught in the pinch between northern and southern forms. The decision is made to go with Rome. England first became Roman Catholic, and then later Ireland and Scotland and Wales became Roman Catholic. That's the basic movement of it. Well, what about Germany? From whence the Saxons came, the northern part of Germany, or at that time called the Holy Roman Empire. Well, Christianity came into Germany. The land, now by this I mean the lands east of the Rhine. Here's the Rhine River. This area in here, east of the Rhine. First of all, it was imposed by Charlemagne and the other Frankish kings. That is, it was either baptism or the sword. Line them up and say, okay, would you like to be Christian? Or would you like to have your head cut off? We will now sing Just As I Am. And they had some great invitation services in those days. And by the way, but that, of course, did not win the hearts of the people. But between the years 700 and 900, missionaries from Anglo-Saxon England came, and they really won the hearts of the people to Christianity. Now, keeping the form of Christianity they were preaching in that day. The outstanding man was Boniface, or he's also called Winfrid. You hear about Saint Boniface. He's a Roman Catholic saint now. He came not bringing the sword, but preaching the word. So he understood the word. And he died, by the way. He was martyred by these barbaric peoples as a result of his preaching the gospel to them. But note this, Christianity came to England, it came up from the south by decree, by Charlemagne, but it really didn't, that's not really won the hearts of the people. It came, Winifred or Boniface and others came over from England and established Christianity in Germany. As we look at Scandinavia now, 900 to 1200, up at north of the Baltic Sea, missionaries from Germany converted the Scandinavian peoples to the Roman form of Catholicism from the beginning. Scandinavia was Roman from the beginning because northern Germany was Roman Catholic because England was Roman Catholic. You got that? From England to Germany, from Germany to the Scandinavian countries. Note the progression. Ireland to Scotland, Scotland to England, England to Germany, Germany to the Scandinavian countries. Remember I said that these people were wild until nobody ever defeated them? They were simply converted and sort of acculturated, calm, they were civilized a little bit. By 1200, the countries, missionaries from Germany, as I say, converted them. The scourges of Europe were gradually integrated into the culture and civilization of Europe. Only then did people could relax from their fear of the wrath of the Northmen. Now keep in mind there, it was a very thin layer of civilization. The Scandinavian countries, as we're going to see, as I suggested before, as we're going to see when we get to the history of Protestantism, have never been converted. There has never been a very much piety, genuine spirituality in the Scandinavian countries as a whole. They're sort of converted as a cultural, as a higher culture overcoming a lower culture, very little else. There has never been very, what I'm saying is this, there has never been very much love for God in the Scandinavian countries. Well, you do not find great pietistic movements and the kind. Some, but not much. The remainder of Eastern Europe, 900 to 1200, including Poland and the Baltic area, were evangelized, moved east, and of course, one of the strongest Roman Catholic countries in the world now is Poland. The Communist Party is finding out. And in summary, by the year 1200, see, we go up to 1122 in this section, Church of the Middle Ages. By the year 1200, just past our period, the countries of Europe were nominally Christian. The countries of Europe were nominally Christian, except for the area around Constantinople. And except for the area around Constantinople, they are Roman Catholic. That is, remember Constantinople lost most of its area in Asia to the Muslims. It had some area, just right around Constantinople, around the area here. But except for some small areas there, it's all Roman Catholic, as opposed to Eastern Orthodox. And again, into Russia, which we're not considering, it was Orthodox, question. Okay. Well, you can see the progression there. Let's turn our attention now to the relation of the church and state, and this is a very complicated topic. What is the relation of the church and the state in the period of the early Middle Ages, 604 to 1122? What is it? Well, the problem is, what state are you talking about? What state are you talking about? And we could just spend hours trying to investigate and talk about the relation of the Roman Catholic Church to each individual state. And it's very complicated. So I'm going to restrict myself to discussing, and I do here in the syllabus, the relationship of the Roman Catholic Church to the dominant power, the closest thing you had to centralized power, which was the church in the Byzantine Empire and the church in the West and the Holy Roman Empire, which we've already met. Okay, first of all, the church in the Byzantine Empire, 332 to 739, the Bishop of Rome controlled the church progressively in the West, while the actual authority and control of the emperor was progressively nominal. The emperor was still in the East. After 739, the Bishop of Rome broke off relations with Constantinople. We've seen that. They've already broken now, and formed an alliance with the Frankish dynasty. That is what came to be the Holy Roman Empire. That is, Rome cast its lot with, Constantinople was kind of a dead issue, cast its lot with the Franks, the dominant tribe in the West. That is, and note this, there was a trade-off, as I indicate here. It was a political move. The Franks, now keep in mind, let me try to create what's going on here, because it's so hard to understand. Remember, everything's breaking down. People are fighting for survival. The cities are being vacated. Law and order is breaking down. Education is going by the boards. This dominant tribe, the Franks, are trying to create a civilization. That's why they came south in the first place, trying to get in on a higher civilization. They're fighting a losing battle. The Franks established the Carolingian Empire, dynasty, which is supposed to be the new Roman Empire, not the pagan Roman Empire, but the holy or Christian Roman Empire. And, but you see, if it's the holy Roman Empire, if it's under God, how do you just go in and arbitrarily say, okay, everybody, this is what we're going to do? It's like going into a mob and saying, okay, everybody, I am going to appoint myself as organizer. We're going to organize this thing now, and you all line up, and here's how it's going to be. What do people say? Well, who died and made you God? Who appointed you? See? And so the Franks are now trying to establish this new empire, establish some order out of this chaos, to perpetuate old Roman civilization and under this new Christian garb. And so, but see, they're not the only tribe. It's a very fragmented society. So, in effect, the Frankish kings are coming into this chaos and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. And they're the most powerful, and they can impose it militarily, but you see, if you impose it militarily, you've got to control it militarily. What they need is legitimacy. Got that? They need legitimacy. They need a transcendental reason or a heavenly reason for people accepting their rule. Kind of the same problem the Caesars had when they began to be in the idea that Caesar is God, see? Divine legitimacy. The church, on the other hand, which had a lot of land, is very wealthy now, they needed protection. They needed the Franks on their side. And so the Frankish leaders simply said this to the leaders of the church, let's make a deal. Constantinople is a dead issue now. The Moslems have taken all the territory, or they're taking it. Constantinople's barely hanging on. And they're so far away, they can't help you. Tell you what we'll do. The Frankish leader said, you legitimize the Holy Roman Empire. You decree, and see, the people were Christian there. They would listen to the church. You tell everybody that they are to obey the king, the Frankish kings, this new dynasty, that it's from heaven. Got this? That God has ordained it. And if the church says that, the people will go along with it. God has ordained this Frankish Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. In return, we'll protect you. You scratch our back, we'll scratch yours. We'll protect your lands. We'll respect your claim to the lands. We'll see that you get your tithes, your taxes. Mom, you'll be okay. See, that is a trade-off. But keep in mind, they were just trying to survive in a decaying world. Does that make sense to you? Well, that's basically the kind of thing that's going on. The bishop needed the king needed the bishop. The bishop needed the king for security, the king needed the bishop for legitimacy. And they got it. The Carolingian dynasty needed to legitimize the rule, I point out. Remember I said the Lombards were between the Franks and the North and the Romans down here, the Lombards right between them, were really a Teutonic people, these blonde-headed Italians. Well, the Lombards, they needed protection. The Lombards were threatening Rome. That was one of the reasons Rome needed to be protected, from the Lombards. So the Franks, who were stronger than the Lombards, said, okay, you say we're king, and we'll tell everybody to keep off your grass and stay out of your territory. In 751, Pope Zacharias, Bishop of Rome, approved the coronation of Pepin, son of Charles Martel. He was keeping his deal. In 754, Stephen II, Bishop of Rome, crossed the Alps up into, it's now France, and personally crowned Pepin again, that is, and proclaimed him patrician of the Romans and anointed him after the Old Testament pattern. See, he kept his deal. The Bishop of Rome, in this case, Stephen II, are you with me now? He went over into Frankish territory, put on this big show, and officially coronated him. That is, heaven has declared this dynasty legitimate. And so, Pepin kept his part of the deal. He conquered the Lombards and gave and left and took over the country, which is northern Italy, and he gave a great deal of that land to the Pope. And by the way, it was at this point that the Pope became officially a civil as well as a spiritual ruler when the Bishop of Rome inherited this land that the Franks, Pepin, had taken from the Lombards and gave it to them to administer.
in a feudal system. I hope this makes sense to you, because what we're trying to do is control a vast amount of material in a long period of time, and it's and we're trying to control by generalizations a very complicated period of time. And so I hope we're doing that. This represents, as I point out, a fundamental change in the theory of kingship. The kings of the Germanic tribes had been military officers holding office by the consent of the aristocrats and generally reflecting the will of the people. Now they rule by divine sanction. With the anointing of Pepin, a German chieftain was for the first time the, quote, Lord's anointed. An anathema was pronounced against any who would fail to recognize his kingship, hence his legitimacy, you see. It became a sin against heaven to revolt against the king. This became the basis of the evolved concept of the divine right monarchy, which, by the way, is important in our own history. One of the big issues in the American Revolution was, does the right to rule come down from heaven? The right, tell me, whoever's going to be in charge, governor, king, prince, no matter what it is, does the right to rule come down from heaven, and therefore cannot be rebelled against, cannot be rejected, or does the right to rule arise from the consent of the governed? If you read the early documents of our, the foundational documents of our republic, that was one of the big issues. The Declaration of Independence was a denial of divine right monarchy. As a matter of fact, when it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they were not talking about racial equality, they were not talking about economic equality, they were not talking about equality of gender, they were not promoting feminism, they were not promoting any kind of equality. All they were saying is, there's no such thing as a divine right king. Got that? That all men are created equal, and that no man has a right from heaven to rule another man. If he's going to rule, it's because we'll choose him to rule. The right, we declare that the right to govern arises from the consent of the governed. Now, I go into this because I say this is important in our own history, but it goes back, if you trace it back historically, in Western Europe. Now, of course, Rome had it, you see, if the emperor was God himself. Pepin was never declared to be God the way Augustus was declared to be God. See, this is a Holy Roman Empire. It's not a pagan Roman Empire. Under a pagan Roman Empire, the emperor is God. Under a Holy Roman Empire, he's just a man, but he rules he has the right to rule because God gives him that authority. And therefore, if God gives him that authority, of course, you have no right to rebel against him or to disobey him. And this was perpetuated in Europe, all of Europe, and comes right down into our own history. Do you see that? But this is where it begins. And that'll be interesting to us. Note this, it came out of this deal, it came out of this situation where the Franks needed a formal sanction of their control of Europe, or what they call the Holy Roman Empire. Well, I hope you're thinking this through and understanding what's going on. It's tough, isn't it, to try to keep track of it. We look now at the famous document, the Donation of Constantine. We're going to see this again when we come to the Reformation history. This becomes a controversial document in the history of the Reformation. The document was an 8th century forgery. No question it's a forgery, by the way. Nobody questions it now. Which became the constitutional basis for the claims of the papacy until after the 15th century. It was Lorenzo Valla, the Renaissance figure, who declared it was false. It's now completely discredited. It seems to have come from about the time of Pope Stephen, we've talked about here, you know, who legitimized Frankish rule. Its author is unknown. We know it was manufactured at Rome. It became, this document, interesting that this forgery became the cornerstone of papal power. And you might wonder how a forged document could take on the force, which would be analogous to, take on weight and importance and authority, analogous to the Constitution of the United States, but it did. What the donation of Constantine was to the Holy Roman Empire, what the Constitution of the United States is to our republic, it became the foundational document. You wonder how they could pull it off if it were not if it were a forgery. But you got to understand, this was an ignorant, superstitious age. There was people didn't have ways of checking. People, it could be, they took the word of the Pope for it. If the Bishop of Rome said it was true, they accepted it as being true. Well, anyway, it purported to record the transference of political power in the West to the Bishop of Rome by Constantine. And I put the donation in there. You can read it for yourself. Was that part of the assignment? Read the donation of Constantine? Yes. Yes. You should have read it for today. Did you? You did not? This was... Yeah, reading Donation of Constantine, Addendum 5. If you haven't read it, do so. I'm not going to take time to go over it in class. But you see, here was the theory. The question was, you see, if... Now follow me. The Frankish king says, we'll protect the church from the Lombards, mainly. We want the Pope, we want the Bishop of Rome, to sanction our dynasty, our rule. And so the Pope, in effect, gave the right to rule Western Europe, this area, the Holy Roman Empire, and France, theoretically, gave the right to rule to these Frankish kings. The next question is, of course, who gave the Pope that right? You can see they would ask. Who said, in other words, well, God did. But you see, it wasn't quite that simple. That was a little hard to swallow. So the donation of Constantine was a forgery. It was used to support all this that was going on, which I've been talking about. And what it said was, in effect, that in return for a miracle, a healing, if you've read it, that the Pope healed Constantine, and he was so grateful that he gave the Bishop of Rome a present. He made a donation. Constantine made a donation, which was what? The political, Western Europe. He gave him that area. Constantine had formally given it to the Pope, therefore he could give it to whoever he wanted. He had control over it. You see that? So if you read the donation, it's reported, legal sort of a title given to the Bishop of Rome of the Western Empire, of the West, really. Do you understand that? As far as we can tell, it was a forgery probably produced by Stephen or some of his courtiers to give legitimacy to what they were doing, added legitimacy. What were they doing? Deciding who was going to be king in the Western Empire. Are you all with me on this? Any questions? Oh, I feel like I'm talking to myself today. Well, it's tough, isn't it, try to control this? Yes. Well, one of the reasons, see, later on, this became the foundational document. That is, whenever anybody questioned the right of the church to appoint kings and to stick their finger in everybody's business in Europe, they would pull out the donation of Constantine. Until finally Lorenzo Valla said it's a forgery and proved it. And of course the Roman Catholic Church denied it was a forgery back then. Of course they admit now that it is. Well, in this larger context, to help you understand what's going on, you see, what they're trying to do is to impose order on a chaotic world. Let's not be too critical. Let's not act like they're stupid. We don't agree with what they did, but do you see what they were trying to do? You see their problem? Trying to create legitimacy, trying to create order out of anarchy. And it's tough to do. They did, by the way, I think they did a pretty good job of it, considering. Well, they just don't say he did it. They just don't know who did it. They don't blame him for it. Nobody, and you can't prove it. We don't know who did it. Whether he did it himself or had it written up. But it was, when he did it, whenever it was produced, and nobody knows exactly when it originated, it was probably justified. You say, well, how could they do this? You know, well, you've got to understand that they were trying to keep their world together. And one of the, by the way, Paul, one of the reasons it was accepted was that when the boat is sinking, you don't sit around and argue about the patch that somebody's going to put in one of the holes. Or if the boat's going down in stormy waters, you don't sit around and argue about who's going to bail. Everybody, you know, the thing's going down. See, Rome is disintegrating. And so here was a document that everybody could look to and say, well, yes, there is order. See, until you've been in a situation where there was no order, any kind of chaos, you don't know how fearful and discouraging it is. It's a terrible thing. It's better to have a despot than it is to have no order. And undoubtedly, those who did it, they simply said, well, we know it's not real, but God will forgive us because the end justifies the means. We've got to glue society back together again. We've got to establish some kind of order, and if people will believe.